Good evening. How is everybody tonight? Good. Awesome. We are a little thin. I can definitely tell. Just number-wise, it looks like we've got a few less people here tonight. But the good news is that leaves plenty of space for you guys to invite somebody to come and be with you next Wednesday night when we continue our discussion. Guys, I didn't grab the, Chris, I didn't grab the clickety-clicker. So last week, we began discussing the concept of knowing our audience. We talked about how important it was when we want to influence people, when we want to change things and encourage people to maybe make some changes in their lives that are good for them, that in order to do that, we're going to have to know who we're talking to. And I introduced this concept through talking about the gospel. And we talked about how there were four accounts of the gospel. And I want to go back and I want to mention that several times I think I stated incorrectly so that there are four gospels. That was not what I intended to say. What I should have said, or what would have been a more accurate way to say that there are four accounts of the gospels. There's only one gospel of Jesus Christ. We know that. But there are four accounts of the gospel of Christ. And we talked about how each one of those gospels seems to be written, the way it's worded, the language that's used, even some of the specific terms that are used seem to be used with the intention of reaching certain audiences and with the importance of reaching an audience. And we talked about how oftentimes we might not find convincing what someone else finds convincing. And that's very, very true. And I used examples, you know, that Patty and I'll call her. You know, we had one just this week. I got so excited because Patty sent me a thing that said Applebee's was doing all-you-could-eat wings. I'm in. I was so excited. Patty's like, yay. What I find exciting and convincing, Patty may not find exciting and convincing. It turns out that's a fluke. It's only like in Texas or something. So what I find convincing may not be convincing to you. What you find convincing may not be convincing to me. And so we continued this, and we were just up to the part where we were going to look at how this is done in Scripture. And I gave you a little bit of homework. Who did their homework? Everybody's getting F's. Acts chapter 17. We were supposed to read Acts chapter 17. All right. Will my slide come up if I hit a button? Maybe? Yeah. So this idea of knowing your audience is a concept that Paul used. Okay, going backwards, we talked about Jesus. How did Jesus use this concept? How did Jesus use the concept of knowing his audience? We talked at length about this last week. Okay, so you're kind of jumping ahead to our next lesson just a little bit, but he used a literary device. Uh-huh. And how did he communicate those things that they did? Which a parable is a story. That's the kind of the word I was looking for there. Jesus told stories. And if Jesus was telling me a story, he'd tell me a story about the little PE teacher that could, because he'd know that would influence me. If he were telling a story to my dad, he might tell a story about the guy who served in the military, about a soldier. That's going to identify with my dad. He was in the Army for 20 years. If he's going to tell a story. And so Jesus was masterful at telling a story to an audience, and he would pin it in, or he would word it in a way that was so beneficial for them. But it's also a concept that Paul used as far as knowing your audience is concerned. Paul, in Acts chapter 17, finds himself up against a, and this is the author's words, not mine, a group of Greek gurus. Gabby Greek gurus. Try to say that five times fast. What did we decide last week about the Greeks? That the Greeks considered themselves what kind of people? Intellectual, very intelligent. And they thought that intelligence was important to them. It was important that they be on the cutting edge as far as intellectual thinking was concerned. Paul knew that he was dealing with people who considered themselves intellectually superior. Have you ever worked with somebody like that or interacted with somebody? That's hard. That's one of those personality types that's difficult for me, but I still kind of stay at it. When somebody considers themselves intellectually superior. And the truth of the matter is that all of us is probably intellectually superior in some way or another to others. There's probably something out there that I am precisely more intelligent about than you. But there's a whole bunch of stuff that you're way more intelligent than I am about. We're all probably like that in some ways. But these people were intellectually, they thought themselves to be intellectually superior. It was in that manner, though, that Paul begins to teach them. He knows their thirst for knowledge, so he starts where they are. Paul's brilliant as he argues from within their worldview. In other times in the book of Acts, and I might be jumping ahead of myself, Paul simply told the story of his conversion. And it did wonders. People were amazed at how Paul was converted. But he doesn't do that to this group. He never mentions his conversion. He never mentions the road to Damascus. He simply starts where they are. So Paul, this is coming from Acts chapter 17, verses 22 through 23. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, there we go, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you." So Paul comes into them and discusses with them at their worldview. Can't you see what Paul's doing? Do you see the subtle genius behind what he's trying? He's not arguing from within his own understanding of the world, but from theirs, starting with their unknown God. He's fitting his message into their mindset rather than immediately challenging their beliefs. You know, think about that. Paul could have gone up to seen all these gods, seen all these statues, all these idols, and he could have said, "What are y'all doing? This is ridiculous. This is, foolish. It's idolatry. What are you? Are you lost your minds?" But he knew that that wasn't the best way to reach these people. As a result, they are staying with him instead of walking away or mentally formulating their rebuttals. A lot of times we talked about that, how a lot of times we want to talk to somebody about something, and rather than hearing each other, we're already forming our responses or our rebuttals. Then he hits the bullseye with this group of intellectuals. He tells them, in essence, "I'm going to help you become truly intellectual." You think how enticing that might have been to that group. You guys think you're intellectual? Let me tell you about something that's beyond intellect. This thing that you've been worshiping as unknown, let me make it known to you. And I can just see them chomping at the bit. He tells them, "What you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you." He earns the right to continue, having won his audience's respect and piquing their curiosity. Notice as Paul continues, he doesn't use Old Testament scripture or his Damascus Road conversion story. Never uses either one of those. To introduce this unknown God, he connects his theology to his audience. He connects his theology to his audience. In verse 28, he uses actually some of their literature as he's speaking to him. It says, "In him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring." So Paul quotes one of their poets back to them to make a connection between their beliefs and Paul's theology. Why would Paul make a second cultural connection here? He's already nailed them with one cultural connection with the unknown God there. He's made one cultural connection. Why go the extra mile and make a second cultural connection? What's he about to do? He's about to break down his most controversial point. He's about to break down the most controversial point because he's going to make the point about the resurrection. And this would have been where he knows he's probably going to say some things that people aren't going to want to hear. But he connected with them twice culturally with the intent of, "I've got something you might not agree with, but I want to develop rapport with you. I want you to know that I care about what you think. I value your opinion. I may not agree with it, but I value your opinion. And I'm going to connect with you culturally in every way that I can." And then he didn't run from the resurrection. He still taught them about the resurrection. And he goes on in Acts chapter 17, verses 30 and 31. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed the day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. So Paul introduces them to the resurrection. What was the result? Well, it's probably about what you would expect. Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, "We'll hear you again about this." So Paul went out from their midst, but some men joined and believed, among whom also were Dionysus the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. So by introducing this difficult concept, Paul got pretty much every response we could expect. Some just laughed. "Paul, you're crazy." Some were curious. Some believed. Y'all, if we could get a 33% breakdown like that when we taught people, we'd be doing okay. If we could get basically one of those three, you know, that those are, you know, I don't want to say they're good numbers, but he got a reaction. 66% of the people that he was working with there, if you think of them just in three different groups, are at least open to the information that Paul's giving to them. They may not be sold out with it yet. They may not be wide open, committed. I completely get it. But they're open to what he's trying to say. That's influence through knowing your audience. Despite the odds, or perhaps because of the odds, Paul shrewdly connects with the Athenian culture, with the Athenians' culture, before even saying a word to them. As a result, he was able to package his message in a way that at least persuaded some. If you were to open to Matthew chapter 10, verse 16, you would read a verse, and it talks about, I believe Jesus is talking specifically to the disciples, and he tells them to be as shrewd as serpents, but gentle as doves. And that's what Paul is right here. Man, he's clever here. This is some serious next level brain ninja work, whatever you want to call it. But he does it in a gentle way, not sacrificing the truth. He didn't ease up on the resurrection. He didn't skirt around it. But as a result, he had real influence with these people. To use a baseball analogy, Paul would not have gotten to first base with this group had he not understood how they thought and what they valued. In the same way, we're more likely to strike out in our influence attempts when we ignore our audience's mindset. I'm not exactly sure what this book passage is. I wrote this lesson or organized for this lesson a few weeks ago. Let's see if I can find it real quick. Let's see what's next. Oh, here we go. Think of the many applications of this principle. Applications we see every day. Teachers learn as much as possible about the age group they'll be instructing before they develop lesson plans and step into the classroom. Missionaries learn all they can about the people they're trying to reach before engaging their culture. Market researchers identify the wants and needs of their target audience before a company creates a product they hope to sell to that influence. Trial lawyers learn what they can about each juror long before ever making their opening argument. I'm sure you can add to this list a lot more examples. The principle applies in almost every influence situation. Before you ever say a word, do your homework, learn, understand, know. Then and only then will you be able to develop an influence strategy that will be effective. All right, and I think that'll close us out on that. All right, so I apologize for rushing through that section, but I'm kind of halfway in between two lessons here, and I hope to make up that time tonight and be able to kind of right this ship. But I do ask you, if there are any comments, please share those now so we can kind of talk about those. How many of you had never thought about Paul's statements there in Acts chapter 17 in that way? I'd never thought of him that way. It's really neat. Maybe you had seen this before. Maybe this didn't escape your study when you had it. But I was like, wow, that's why he did that. I thought he was just calling them out because they had some unknown God and they didn't realize that that was the one true God. No, Paul did it in a very clever way. And I think... Yeah, so yeah, Paul may have felt like, you know, I don't know how else I'm going to reach these folks. Yeah, I don't know how else I'm going to reach these folks unless I do it from this perspective. Chris, you look like you might want to say something. No? You're good? Anybody? Right, even though he was. Yeah. Yeah, and we're gonna notice Paul's going to be used a lot more in this next lesson. These next couple lessons are some of my favorite from the book because they're taking passages of Scripture that I'm very familiar with and making me go, how did I not see that? Like, I mean, I'm like 37 years old. I'm reading the Bible. I'm going, how did I not see that? That's just, first of all, the power of the Word. And number two, it's my ignorance at never picking up on some of this stuff. All right? So we talked about three principles that all needed to happen before we ever said a word. We talked about praying. We talked about knowing our audience. And we talked about being the kind of person that others want to follow. All three of those happen before we ever say a word to people. Now we're going to begin with influence principles that actually cause us to talk to somebody. It's about to get real. For the last 3 weeks, we've just prepared mentally. We've prepared for what we're going to do, but now we're going to do our best to connect with somebody. That's what we want to do. So we're now going to move towards laying a foundation of respect and relationship. And the way we're going to do that is to connect through similarity. And that's actually a concept that Miss Melissa introduced to us last week when she talked about when she tried to talk to people about the gospel and about becoming a Christian, that she didn't always start with what they needed to do. Sometimes she connected with them about the things that she used to do that she's glad she didn't participate in anymore. And I thought that was a brilliant way to connect with people. So we're going to talk about connecting through similarity. I want to read this story. There's a story in here. And this book calls it a common story, or when it opens it up, it says that it's a story you may have heard. I thought I had heard just about every preacher's joke and story that there ever was, and I had not heard this one. So maybe if it's new to me, it's new to you. And I'm going to adapt it a little bit as I tell it. But it's an interesting story nonetheless. It was Christmas Eve, and the Jones family was heading to church. Everyone except Dad. Dad had little use for churches. He thought they were full of hypocrites, and besides that, God becoming man? Sorry, that was simply too bizarre to be believable. So he had stopped attending years ago. This particular Christmas Eve was an especially easy decision for him. It was snowing a lot. He even tried to talk his wife out of lugging the kids through the storm. But they went anyway, and he curled up by the fire with his remote. A few minutes after they left, the man heard a noise at the bay window. A small bird was trying to get in the house to escape the snow. The man watched with uncharacteristic empathy as the bird fluttered desperately from pane to pane, attracted by the light inside. The man went out to see if he could help. He knew there wasn't much he could do, but he did have a shed nearby. Maybe, he thought, I can shoo the bird into the shed so it'll ride out the storm. Well, as you can imagine, his attempt was almost comical. Every time the man came near, the bird just flew to another window and continued its futile attempt to escape the elements. Eventually, snow started to accumulate on its head and body. The man, more of a snowman himself by this point, made one last attempt to chase the bird to safety, but it was hopeless. Birds don't understand people. They're afraid of people. They flee from them. And that's just what this bird did. Then a strange, seemingly nonsensical thought came to the man. If only I were a bird. Even for 1 minute, I could lead this bird to the safety of the shed. If only I were a bird. Silly thought. But then again, maybe it wasn't. In fact, Maybe it was a divinely planted thought. You see, at that very moment, it dawned on the man why God may have taken on human flesh. Maybe God, too, wanted to lead us out of danger. And maybe the best way to do that was for God to become like us. So this man has this revelation-type moment. As he's trying to simply help a bird in, he thinks, if I could just be a bird for a few seconds, I could explain to this bird what to do. And it dawned on him, because I've wondered that before, why did God choose men? Why did God want Jesus to become a man? Why not make him so much more than a man? Why not make him something that would set out, be set apart, and something that would be distinguished? Why make him a man? And I think we're going to find out that it was because that would be Jesus' best way to get others to join God's cause. You see, I ended up writing the last little bit there, so we won't read that again. All right? Similarity opens the door to influence. Similarity opens the door to influence. Aren't we more receptive to the idea of those who are like us? Just as a general rule. We're typically more receptive to ideas and things from people that are like us. Now, this lesson might make you only pursue people who are just like you. That's not at all what I'm saying. I'm saying that as you pursue all mankind, you are inevitably going to have to find some similarities even with those people that you're very different from. You know, I've heard it said of youth groups and of churches in general that we want a diverse group. We want a group that, of all different walks of life, because that's what we have the potential to attract. You know, we might want to consider, you know, I don't want friends that are just like me. That would be pretty boring. I know what I'm like. I want people who are different from me. I want people who are unlike me. And so, even though we're talking about finding a similarity, you may want to examine yourself if you find out that the only friends or acquaintances that you have are exactly like you. Might be some room for some growth there. We listen more closely when someone has a viewpoint that closely aligns with ours, and that's spiritually and politically. You know, there's a lot of political information going around, a lot of spiritual information, and we have our views, and we hear somebody over here kind of going along with our views, and it's real easy to go over here and go, yeah, that's how I feel about that. I agree. Yep, absolutely, 100%. And we're more likely to respond to somebody if they have some views that kind of closely align with ours. Who can comfort us better than someone who's gone through the same trial? You know, hey, you talk about people go through things. You know, we go through things so that people can benefit from what we've gone through. You know, I think it'll embarrass her, but I know that my wife has intentionally reached out to people who have lost their fathers. Well, why? Why would she be a good candidate for that? Because she lost her father. She's going to try to appeal to someone, and they might be tempted to push her away. You don't know what I'm going through. But she does. We're more likely to receive that information when somebody that's gone through it receives that, presents that information to us. At work, isn't our opinion of our company shaped by our coworkers rather than the managers who are three levels up the corporate ladder? You know, at my school, the teachers, we get together and we talk about the environment at our school. I don't necessarily do that with those that are in charge, because that's who I have a similarity. I don't have a similarity with those administrators and those people that are a little bit higher up that hierarchy. I have similarities with the teachers who are there with the students each and every day. At stores, we see women selling cosmetics. Well, why? Because women buy cosmetics. It makes sense. Why do we see those commercials on TV of 70-year-olds selling low-cost life insurance to senior citizens? because they're trying to identify a similarity between the two groups. All right? Any thoughts as we're just kind of introducing this topic here? The influence through similarity principle is everywhere. Why do you think youth ministers try so hard to be plugged in to their teenagers' lives? You know, Hunter's not in here tonight, but why do you think Hunter goes to the kids' ball games? Why do you think, you know, I try to talk to the kids about things that I think they're interested in? Sometimes I'm genuinely interested in it myself. I know Chris talks football and sports with all the guys. Well, why? Well, yes, we might genuinely enjoy that, but even if we didn't, it's a way I can connect with them. And I do that with lots of you guys. I do that with you. I intentionally do that. Hey, what's going on with this? Hey, how's that going? You know, hey, Dwayne, how you been doing in the gym, man? You know, is everything going good? Are you still hitting your goals in the gym? I may not be interested in the gym at all, but I know Dwayne is. And that might be a way for me to reach him. I talked to Steve about his work. I don't know anything about putting appliances in. I don't know a thing except I better call Steve. But I want Steve to know that what I think, what he does is interesting, and that's the similarity. And in fact, I fixed my dryer a couple months ago with the help of Steve and a couple others over the phone. Man, there's a similarity between me and Steve. If I want to influence him in some way, having that similarity, going out of my way to nurture that relationship, is going to mean a lot towards influencing him. Looking for these similarities to try to influence. In many cases, we may need to build a bridge that spans a generation gap. You may be trying to influence somebody who's from a different generation, either literally or you hear people using the terms, well, he's an old soul. You might have to bridge a generation gap. The best way to bridge that generation gap is by using a bridge called relationship. And it leads to a place or a land called trust. If we're going to influence people, they got to trust us. The only way they're going to trust us is if we build a relationship. And one of the ways we might be able to build a relationship is if we find something in common with someone. Find something that we have in common with them. Any thoughts as we're kind of just blowing through this? Y'all are quiet tonight. The best way to establish the relationship necessary to credibly share the gospel is to be similar to those we are trying to reach. Why did I underline the word credibly? Aside from, don't give me the standard, it's important. I know it's important. That's why I underlined it. What about that word is important? Can you share the gospel in an uncredible, is that a word, way? Or in a way where you have no credibility? What do you think? I think you have to have their trust. And if you don't have someone's trust, you're not credible to them. And no matter how true, hear, believe, repent, confess, be baptized, remain faithful is, if you're not credible in their eyes, is that information ever going to sink with them? Is it ever going to really sink in with them? The information's true. Yeah, man, you got to hear, you got to believe, you got to repent, you got to confess, you got to be faithful, got to get involved in the church, get in there, do your work, be a part of, you know, go teach the word, be instant, in season, out of season, you got to do that. But if you're not credible to that person, it's going to be hard to build relationships with them. They may think, what now? Yeah, I'm kind of getting away from where I'm wanting to go with this, but it has sense, this idea of being credible. Again, I use teacher examples. I'm a teacher, forgive me. Hopefully these translate to you in some way. But I know I got a few other teachers in here. Patty, is Tara in here? Ginger's in here. Ginger, is there anything worse in the world than having to call a sub? Like, well, first of all, we can't get subs, okay? That's very difficult. And then no matter what detailed plans I give, what do you always got to do when you get back from a substitute, Ginger? You got to sort out all the drama. Y'all, I'd rather be sick and puking my guts out than miss a day of school. Because there is so much drama to sort out when I'm gone. Well, why? The sub's going to tell them the same information that I tell them. Hey, sit down, turn around, do your job. They're probably going to say it a lot nicer than I say it. Why? Why won't they listen to that teacher? Because that teacher has no rapport with those students. None. That teacher doesn't know those students. Doesn't know the gentle way you have to nudge this one. The stern way you have to get after that one. She just comes in and tries to use my information. And it usually is a, what is the phrase? A dumpster fire. That's what it looks like. And so when I try everything in my power not to be sick. When I was a young teacher, man, I'd feel a sniffle. I'm like, I'm going to have to miss about 2 days for this one. Man, I've taken my lung in my hand now on the way because I'm like, it ain't worth it. I'd rather just, listen, I'll be sick and sort it all out because when I'm gone, it falls apart. Why? Because she doesn't have, he or she doesn't have rapport. It doesn't matter if they're an experienced sub. It doesn't matter if they're a young sub. It doesn't matter if they're old. If they used to teach PE, I've had certified PE teachers who have been torn apart in my class. Why? Because they don't have rapport with the students. We've got to be credible with the people that we're trying to influence. That's what this whole book is about. In order to influence people, I've got to be credible. I've got to make myself worthy of showing them that influence that I want to show them so badly. Other thoughts? Patty? Yeah, so she says you may have the rapport with them, but the way you live your life may not allow you to be credible. Absolutely. You going to say something? Yeah. She's pretty smart, man, I'm telling you. Have to practice what you preach. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right? Okay. Where do we see this in the mission field? I wish Brother Harry was with us, but he's not here tonight. Where do we see this in the mission field? Chris, when you go to Haiti and you convert a guy, what's the first thing you want him to do? Okay, so that's a given. Next thing, he's going to be right in the middle of the country that you were just in trying to minister. What do you want him to do? Why him? Why not you? Why not stay there longer? He has a foothold in that culture. The very first thing they do in countries where they share the gospel and it's not very prevalent is they take those four or five converts and they say, now you guys got to start sharing the word. You guys know the country of India, China, Africa. It's a continent, not a country. You guys know this environment better than we do. You share the gospel. Why? Because they have similarities with those people. No way! People are persuaded by similar people more than they are persuaded by dissimilar people. And the greater the similarity, the greater the likelihood of persuasion. The greater the likelihood of persuasion. This is a quote from the author. I agree with it, but it is not my quote. It is his. He says, I believe this is why God took on human flesh and walked among us for 3 decades. And I believe further that this is why Jesus looked no different from those of his day. Wore similar clothing, lived like they did, ate what they ate, and drank what they drank. He was different from them in many respects, for sure, but similar enough in ways to lead them and now us out of the winter storm like the bird. All right, so Paul boldly and directly used the same similarity principle. All right, where and when? Give me just a sliver of a passage. Went to the synagogue. So he always went to where? Yep, absolutely. Now, that wasn't the exact route that this author went and where we're going to go, but that's going to factor here in just a second. What did Paul say he had become to all men? I have become all things to all men. Let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 19 through 22. For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. To the Jews, I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became one as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the gospel of law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became the weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. Paul said, hey, whenever I meet somebody, I find a similarity to them for one reason, in the hopes of reaching them. When I'm around the Jews, I try to act like the Jews act. When I'm around other folks, I try to act the way. And he wasn't being insincere. It's not a compromise or inconsistency, but it's a shrewd art of adaptation. He's adapting to the environment in which he's in. The book said this, and I think this too. I do not think this of Chris, so don't think that's where I got this. But a lot of preachers today kind of fall victim to using what I call off-the-shelf messages or sayings that are kind of prepackaged to be, you know, maybe super eloquent or to try to dazzle your ears in order to reach those and to affect those that they reach. They try to do that. But that's not what Paul ever did. He did not preach that way. Paul used messages that elicited real change and real transformation of hearts. Those results, to truly change someone's heart and to cause them to have a transformation, you're going to have to start on common ground. And that's what Paul was willing to do. You might even argue that his name was changed to be more effective in the Gentile world. Before this Bible class, I got into a very good study with Chris Gentle and Sarah and thought about who changed Paul's name. You ever thought about that? Who was that? Did you figure it out, Steve? Who changed Paul's name? I'll tell you who I thought it was. I thought it was God. I thought God changed Paul's name. I thought that was like in the Damascus Road conversion. And you know, you're going to go to Damascus, and now I call thee Paul instead of Saul. Nope. It's just likely that Saul's name is Saul in the Hebrew tongue, and it's Paul in the Gentile or Roman tongue. Why would he change it? Because he wanted to be more like those people that he was going around. Now, he probably also wanted to abandon anything having to do with Saul of Tarsus, because he was a pretty rough dude. But Paul is going into new Gentile territories. He wanted to sound like one of the Gentiles so that he would have some credibility with them. This approach might have even saved Paul's life once or twice. These two examples here are pretty cool, and I don't want to rush through them. Two examples. If you want more homework, I've only got like three slides left. But if you want some homework, read Acts chapter 22 and Acts chapter 23 and show me where Paul uses the similarity principle to literally save his life. Paul uses the similarity principle to save his life, twice at least, Acts chapter 22 and Acts chapter 23. Let me take a minute real quick and just ask you this. You don't have to let me know. Let one of our elders know. Let Chris or somebody know. Are you enjoying this class? And I'm not looking for a response right now. I don't need a pat on the back. That's not why I'm doing this. Is there a way I can present class that would be more interesting, more beneficial to others? Let me know how you're enjoying this. If there's something that I do that's off-putting, let me know, and I'll try to work on that. But, you know, give me some feedback. Let me know what you think of class. Let our elders know, and it'll help make me a better teacher. That's what I want to be. I want to be a better teacher, so you guys can let me know. Thank you so much for your attention, and we'll let the little ones come in now.